And if you want to be a part of the conversation too, then subscribe to my Patreon, www.patreon.com/MrChaz, and join the conversation. Ask your own questions.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Leadership, Parenting, and Teaching Podcast, where I introduce you to the people that can help you on your leadership, parenting, or teaching journey. And today, I got an episode that I'm really excited to share with y'all. This is, you know, some people, I went to their presentation. It was a really great presentation that I got to experience and see. I actually shared some of their presentation online. I got a lot of really great feedback. I also got a little bit of feedback of people who were concerned about some things. And it wasn't, I didn't put too much into context. So we get to get all the context today. But before we dive into the conversation and what we're talking about, I want them to introduce themselves because they are such a dynamic duo. And I think this is really going to be impactful for so many people out there listening, especially if you have a child who is quote unquote not typical. So I will let them introduce themselves. I'm going to get right into the conversation.
All right. Hi, Chaz. We are super excited to be here with you today. My name is Jenny Cutler. I am currently a special education teacher in a self-contained special ed classroom in Wisconsin. This is my 27th year in education. My first 18 years were in another district in a general ed classroom teaching first grade. I always had my general ed licensure and my special ed licensure, figured that when I got out of college that I would become a special education teacher. So what my dad did, I grew up, you know, going to his classroom with him on my days off and just kind of knew that was where my heart was. And a general ed classroom just kind of landed in my lap almost. So I stayed there for 18 years, but my heart was always with the most struggling students. They always have my heart. Yeah. Then the last 6 years that I was in that district, I was able to co-teach with a very good friend of mine. We were both gen ed teachers and we had a large class of first graders that we co-taught together out of the same classroom. And then a position opened up in the district that I'm in now that involved co-teaching. And that just spoke very much to me. General ed with special ed and our most severe special ed students, feeding tubes, blind, mute, wheelchair bound, were fully integrated into classrooms. And that just really spoke to me. So this is where I ended up and where I met Alyssa, who you'll meet in just a minute. We have been co-teaching together now for
year 10.
This is year number 10, which is crazy. We co-taught at a different building for a number of years together. This is the third year in this current building where we now teach a self-contained group of students. A lot of trauma, a lot of mental health issues. We were asked to start our program here because our administrators knew that our heart was with conscious discipline and that we were able to do some things with some really tough students, and they wanted to see what we would be able to do with this population and to help spread conscious discipline to our current school. So that's where we are.
I am Alyssa Uredel, the other half of the duo. I have taught my entire career in the same district. This is, I think, year 16. I started out fresh out of college as an EBD teacher, had no skills, no idea what I was doing. And if I could go back and redo all of those kids, I would do a whole lot better by them. But you know, you do better when you know better. So I can do that differently now. I taught there for a few years, then moved to a different elementary school in the district because the district did make the big push for full inclusion and co-teaching. So I co-taught there with another special ed teacher, still with a pretty significant group of kids that weren't able to spend much time in their general ed classroom. And then a few years into that is when Jenny and I met and started co-teaching together. And here we are now. And not only do I use a lot of my conscious discipline skills at school, but I also have three little boys at home that suck every ounce of conscious discipline life out of me that I have left by the time I get home from school.
As do the husbands. Oh,
Well, I don't think we're going to talk too much about the husbands on this episode, but maybe a part two.
They wouldn't want to listen to that, though.
Now, so I want to talk about, so I actually sat in on your presentation. It's always so hard going to these conferences because there are so many great topics and you never know what you're going to get, you know, from any one of the topics. But when I sat in on your topic, something that really impressed me was how many examples that you guys shared with the group. And I could tell you guys were really, really heavy on using visuals. I don't think I've seen, conscious discipline is big on using visuals, but I don't think I've seen a presentation with as many visual examples as y'all gave. And so I want to, you know, it's obviously something that you are both very comfortable with doing, are completely invested in and using, but I want to like kind of understand, like what was your journey with visuals and like, how do you use them? And if someone is like, okay, so I need to start using visuals at home, in the classroom or at home in my household or in the classroom, but I'm not really sure how it's going to work. Or maybe I did use a visual and I felt like it wasn't effective or worth the effort of making them. I would love to kind of hear what your journey was on using visuals and what you found really helpful in using visuals. And just give us a little bit of advice. And why do you use visuals so much? I asked about like six questions in there, but go. Yeah,
well, they make your life easier. That's why we use them.
Oh my goodness. And I think my journey with visuals really between teaching a young grade, starting, you know, 18 years in first grade, and then also my special ed degree. So between teaching pre-readers, when they come into first grade, they aren't reading very much, and knowing what I know about special education, visuals just always seemed very natural to me and made a lot of sense. Because when kids aren't able to read the written word and you can put a picture to it, there's just so much power in that. And it really helps make them more independent and less reliant on me as a teacher, especially when I was one teacher, a gen ed teacher in a classroom of 18 or 24 kids, giving them tools to help them become more independent and less reliant on me made my life easier and it made them more successful.
We have had the conversation a lot of, especially the group of kids we work with now, that engagement and power struggles that they're so often looking for. And when it's not my words and it's not me speaking, that power struggle really goes away because the kids look at the picture. And yeah, they might talk back to the picture, but the picture's not going to talk back to them. So they just look at it, fine, and go and do what they need to do. The number of times that we have said the same words over and over and over, and then stop saying it and hold up a visual of what we're asking them to do. And then the eyes roll and they grunt and away they go.
As I'm sitting at my table where I teach, talking to you, Chaz, right behind me is my tub. And I really love visuals, but I especially love a visual that's attached to a popsicle stick. It's kind of what I'm famous for around here. If I can put into a visual and put it on a stick and share it with people, I certainly will. So, you know, I'm holding up a zero level voice. So when our kids are working independently around us, we don't have to keep saying, you know, be quiet, be quiet, be quiet, or hear people, the dreaded shh, which is louder than the person talking and drives me nuts.
Yeah,
I can not bat an eye. I don't have to stop what I'm doing. And I just have this at the ready and can reach, hold it up.
And it
it's
works.
Taken care of. And our kids respond to it. They just know there is so much power. They're predictable. It never changes. The visual is what it is. It always has the same meaning. And Alyssa said it, like, it's not me with that Charlie Brown right in their ear.
The power of visuals at home too is huge. So my husband and my three children get home before I do. And I walked into the house for a number of days at the beginning of the school year. And there were three backpacks and three lunch boxes and 24 shoes and hats and coats all over our entryway to our house. And it was driving me crazy. But I wasn't there at that time to fix that, to teach the kids where to put their things. So I created a visual and I stuck it on the wall right next to where they're supposed to put all of their things. And I walked each one of my kids through it day after day after day. And then eventually I gave one of my kids the job of being the keeper of the visual. Can you make sure that your brothers are putting their things where they are so that when I walk in the door, I don't have to go, oh, why is this stuff here? And I can walk in and feel that sense of calm instead of anxiety of now there's a mess to clean up. And it's been a game changer. They know what's expected. They know exactly where things go. And the really cool thing is the first time I made it, I brought it home and I set it on the table in front of my six-year-old who's in kindergarten, a pre-reader, like Jenny said. And I said, buddy, talk to me about this. What are we going to do here? I can't read this, mom. I said, but I think you can. Take a look at it. And he put his finger on the first one. Well, first we're going to put our backpack on the shelf and then we're going to put our shoes in the cubby. And then we're going to take our lunchbox and put it on the counter. Every single picture that I had on there that I had words next to is exactly the words that were coming out of his mouth. And he couldn't even read the words. So I hadn't even taught that to him. He could just look at that and know what to do without me even having to walk him through that step by step. So that power of kids' brains think in pictures.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. They don't need somebody to give them those words to feel it. They can look at it and know.
Especially when those words that you'd probably be using in that time are coming from your emotional state and may sound a little nagging.
Yeah.
You in your executive state, it speaks for you when you can't.
Tone to it.
Mm-hmm. Visuals don't have tones.
Nope.
Even though in my head, I might be thinking that. I'm holding up to be quiet.
I think that maybe the facial expression might be.
Hold the visual in front of your face so they can't see it.
Okay. Hold the visual in front of your face so they can't. Okay. Good tip. Good tip there.
My favorite is when our kids walk over to get one of our visuals to hold up for somebody else that they know is struggling with something.
Yeah.
They pick the visual that they know they need. Yeah.
Okay. So I like this. You mentioned you actually created a visual and I think you said first grader?
It was
kindergartner who wasn't able to read was able to read the visuals and kind of really understand what the expectations were able to tell you what the expectations were and without you having to actually walk him through it. Yep. Now, let me ask you this, though, so we can get really down in the details. I'm sure there have been times where you've maybe had to explain or walk through it with children. Explain that for someone who's never done this before. Like, how do you walk a child? So, okay, you may create the visual. Maybe it's for a bedtime routine or a transition. You know, how do you walk them through that? What is your process? What have you found to be successful? And then also maybe add, are there any common mistakes that are made when trying to implement visuals?
Well, the conscious discipline calls it map it out. Model, add visuals, practice, practice, practice. So the first step is modeling with your own body what it should look like, what you want them to do. Then you add the visuals to it and walk step by step by step by step through it and practice, 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 practice. And then
practice when they're calm.
Right.
Because if they're in the middle of a fire drill, as one of our trainers said, you don't want to teach somebody to tie their shoes in the middle of a fire drill.
So yeah.
Calm and ready to take it on as part of that practice before it becomes independent for them.
And then even once it does become independent for them, there's going to be a time that they forget what it is they're supposed to do. And then you rewind and you start over and oops, let's go through this together again. Practice, 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 practice. And a lot of the visuals that we make that are step-by-step like that have checkboxes next to each step. So that step one, let's do it. Let's check it off or cross it off so we know that's done. Let's look at step two. It is a very methodical practice that takes a lot of time if the visual is truly going to work for a child.
You have to make sure they understand. Mm-hmm. There are times when we use our kids' pictures actually doing that event or whatever it is that they're doing. And then there's times that we add some clip art. So whatever picture or visual you're using, you have to make sure it means something to them. I like to share this story that we shared at Elevate. I had listened to a podcast and by a behavior specialist, and she had talked about the difference between pause and stop. So I thought, oh, it was super powerful that when kids hear the word stop, it means it's gone, you know, forever, like it's never coming back. But if they hear the word pause, they understand that, oh, I may need to step away from it for a few minutes, but it's not gone, that I eventually get to come back to it. So I had made a pause button visual, you know, just cut a piece of clip art with the two straight lines like we see on all of our electronics. And I had them sitting on our paraprofessionals table to see if she would be able to laminate them and cut them out. And she came in and she asked why she was cutting out and laminating all these number 11s. What does the button look like?
Yeah.
We introduced it to our kids, you know, hold it up. Does everybody know what this button or what this symbol means? Yep, they knew what it meant. Tell us what you think that means and what do you do? And so really making sure that the audience that you're presenting the visual to understands the meaning. A lady at one of our sessions that we taught in Louisville thought it was an electric outlet.
Yeah.
Making sure you're clear and that they really understand and know what that visual is or it'll lose the power.
Yeah. So modeling it, you know, you just actually literally physically with your body showing them what you're expecting them to do. Then you add the visuals, you know, let them see it, you know, you talk about it, you make sure on the same page, maybe have them tell you what it is, what they think it is, and then practice. So what does that, are you talking about practice in the moment? Are you talking about practice, you know, going through it with their body? Are you talking about practice? What exactly does practice look like for you?
It kind of reminds me of when you're teaching an academic content area, the I do, we do, you do.
Yeah.
Practice, like I'm going to show you first so that you get the right picture in your head of what this should look like. Then we're going to do it side by side together. And then I know that you're going to be able to do this on your own. So,
but I'm still there while you're doing it alone.
To coach you through it.
So that if something goes wrong,
you're going to make mistakes.
Yep. We're here for you. Like the visual doesn't replace me, the teacher. Mm-hmm. It just helps make the steps or whatever it is you are doing.
And making it fun, making it, it's not like, now we're going to do this and then we're going to do this. And it's like a punishment for the kid. Like you can't figure this out. So now we have to do this because you need to feel terrible about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the idea of it. The idea is it's a teaching tool. We're going to have fun together learning this new skill, because if you can learn this new skill, that's going to ripple into several other skills that you're going to need. So making it fun and making it a game and, you know, how fast can we do this? Or, you know, however you can make
covering up pieces. What do you think is going to come next after you've practiced a little bit? Do you remember what the next step is?
Yeah. You know, it's that paradigm shift of, you know, a lot of us think that we have to change behavior, we have to get the child to feel bad about what they're doing. There has to be a negative experience.
You know, it's just the opposite. Kids do better when they feel better, just like these adults do.
Yeah. Yes.
You do your best when you feel like dirt.
Yeah. 100%. And I will also say too, that after your presentation, I went back to my classroom and I started putting visuals on sticks, because it's just the nice mobile thing. And I even will let the kids use it too. And, especially, you know, some of the kids who might have a harder time really like focusing in on maybe like the silent, like I'll have, okay, you're going to be the one that's going to show everyone. You're going to be the model.
Looking at their job.
Right. 100%. What you offer to others, you strengthen yourself, right?
Absolutely.
So thank you for that. So now we're going to get into, thank you for so much talking to us about visuals and how did we talk about the common mistakes when using visuals?
We did. There are lots of them.
One of them Alyssa already mentioned, and when we present, we do share some of our oopses. Like when we're looking back through our documents Which visuals do you think we should share with them, or, you know, what would be powerful to see? We do include some of the mistakes that we made, where we have, we called it a visual, but it was one page words. And it had steps, you know, step one, step two, step three, but it was all words. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter what grade you're teaching, whether it's pre-K, second grade, third grade, fifth grade, high school. Just, we know that kids' brains think better in pictures. Mm-hmm. So to have a whole sheet of steps and it's all words with, you know, a cute little checkbox, because I thought it would be so fun. You step one and check it off and you look at that page and
daunting.
It is. For me, it hurts my eyes now to look at it. So fewer words, most support comes through the picture.
Mm-hmm. Another mistake is not enough practice. Or like you talked about before, practicing in a punitive way. Like, you know, it feels yucky. It's not going to teach them because they're going to be in their emotional state or their survival state if that's what it feels like. And then they're not learning from it because we know the only place you can learn is in your executive state. If we do have, you know, some visuals on sticks that occasionally it might feel really good to get it in the kid's face just to make sure they can see it, you know, because the closer I get to you, the clearer that will be. And that, again, is coming from not my executive state. So even though it's a visual and it doesn't have tone behind it, the kids can feel your energy. So
your intention behind it,
it matters. Still
matters.
Yeah.
Are you looking to help or are you looking to hurt? Visuals definitely what we want to put in place, like everything we do. Our job is to help. Mm-hmm. There was another common mistake. Oh, too much information.
Yeah.
I think on a visual. Mm-hmm. Like the more concise and the less on the page or whatever it is you're showing them is definitely easier for kids to follow.
Even if that means a little white space on the paper, which is really hard for Jenny. She likes to fill every ounce of space. Sometimes I have to remind her that's taking away from what you want them to know. Get rid of it.
Yeah.
Less is more in a lot of cases with visuals.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I really think the importance of remembering, it doesn't matter how old the child or the student is, that the visual piece, the adding the pictures to it, is still the most important part of it.
Here's a funny mistake we made one time. If you color code things, make sure that your kids are not colorblind. Many moons ago when we co-taught together in a second grade classroom, we still had centers for readers workshop.
Literacy centers.
So, and we color coded them. If you're in the red group, you start here. If you're in the blue group, you start here. And every day we had a student that could never figure out which center he was supposed to go to.
And we would teach and reteach.
Here's Do you see your name? Do you see this? This is today. So we were trying to model ad visuals in practice. And then we realized,
we found out he's colorblind.
He's colorblind.
That's an important piece of information.
Yeah. Yeah. How did you find out? Out of curiosity.
He did not tell us. Somebody else told us.
A former teacher told us. Telling the story, like how frustrated we were because we were trying to make this easier for him. And they said, well, you know, he's colorblind, right? But now we can fix that.
Okay. Yeah. Good.
Knowing your audience.
Yeah.
Is hugely important.
Yeah. You know, I talk a lot about, you know, I say see, guide, trust. And a lot of times we don't really see the child for whatever reason. We don't have enough information. We haven't spent enough time with them. But a lot of times we will try to guide before we really try to understand. And sometimes we're just missing a piece of information about the child or something about understanding the child. And then our guidance is going to be so much more effective once we're actually seeing them. So when we can go to them and meet them where they're at.
Exactly.
Yeah. Love it. Love it. Love it. All right. So we're going to talk about the little bit of controversy.
So shocking to us. Yeah, for a lot of reasons. But why don't you explain the background?
So I'm at Elevate and I'm taking pictures and I'm sharing. And when I'm going to conferences, it's you know, I try my best to share. Like my whole goal is to bring people with the conference to me. But obviously there's going to be a lot of things lost in not being in the room. And I'm not recording everything. It's just taking pictures. And so I thought, so I was taking pictures and posting them to the story. And one of the visuals had a little bit, I guess it was an eating chart that labeled, kind of had, you know, one bite, two bites, three bites, four bites. I think it went up to maybe like six bites or something like that. And the concern, a lot of, it got some messages, concern of, you know, pretty much people interpreting the visual, right? And again, this is just a visual and people interpret it in so many different ways, especially on the internet. You know, we shouldn't be forcing kids to eat bites, or we shouldn't be making children feel bad because they're not, you know, eating as much. They need to learn to listen to their body. They,
eating disorders was one of them.
Right. And I think, and I wish I actually had that visual up. I think there was something, there was a little note
on the bottom.
On the bottom.
It was something along the lines of, if I, you know, I need to eat in order for my brain to grow so I can do my best learning, or something along those lines. I don't have it sitting in front of me, but it was something like that.
Something along those lines. Yeah. And yeah. So now you have felt the wrath of the internet. Welcome to my world. you now have an opportunity to kind of explain, you know, how you were using it, what it's, you know, what it's for, and kind of just talk. Just share.
Come at this from two ways. So first is how it was used and what it was made for.
It was used at home with one of my boys, who is notorious for, I'm going to come to the dinner table, I'm not going to eat supper, but then I'm going to ask for dessert 10 minutes later. And it was, and every night at dinner ended up being a power struggle. It was, you know, you have to eat something, you haven't eaten since lunch, like your belly needs food, yet like yada, yada, yada. So, you know, using my teacher tools, I made this chart, I took it home and I explained to him, I said, buddy, you have to eat something. You haven't had any food since lunch.
Your brain needs food.
Like, that's part of, you know, we don't need you to be hangry, because hangry is a real thing with him. So what do you think of this? And we, you know, we talked about, how many bites do you think would be best for you? What if you're not hungry? What if you don't like the food? What, we talked through all of the what ifs, and together we came up with, I'm going to take six bites, even if I don't like it, even if I do like it, because I know that I have to have some sort of nourishment in my body. Put the check boxes on during supper. Supper became delightful. The power struggle went away. He got fed. We could carry on with our evening.
So that was the visual that was shared.
Okay.
Because we had some home visuals, and we had some, you know, that we've made for kids to use in other places. The other piece of this is, this was not a visual that we made for school.
Right.
However, we do teach in a very high poverty school, where food is definitely an issue for our kids, that if they don't get fed and they don't eat at school, then they don't eat at
home. They come back for breakfast the next morning.
Our kids take home bags of food on Friday to get them through the weekend. So we do talk a lot with our kids about what a healthy brain needs. And, you know, we know that there are things that your brain needs. Your brain needs to move, it needs to relax, it needs to nourish, it needs to think, it needs to connect with other people. And eating healthy foods, we spend a lot of time talking with our kids about what healthy foods and not healthy foods are, and your brain needs protein, and you know, because they don't know that information. And again, food shortage and not having access to a well-balanced, healthy diet outside of school is a real issue for some of our kids. So we at school don't force our kids to eat, but they are definitely encouraged, you know, what did you eat for lunch today? And
I will also say that after all of that feedback came from you posting that visual, I thought about things in a different way. Like, those were not things that were crossing my mind. Of course, I would never want to leave my child having an eating disorder, or to overeat, or to eat the wrong, like, that is never my goal as a parent. But again, you do better when you know better. And those weren't even real things that I thought I might be creating in my child. So thanks, internet, for the feedback, because it, you know, I do see things from a different perspective now. But I also know, when I, like Jenny said, when I think about our school population, and when kids bring a bag of Takis for snack and sit and polish off the entire bag, is that the nourishment that they need to sustain their learning for the rest of the day? Or would...
Especially for developing brains. Right. You know, we know that young brains especially need
protein and
healthy food.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Two really big points that, you know, obviously the, you know, people who are watching who were looking at the visual didn't have that context. I didn't even have that context from the presentation, but that was, you know, really powerful of just, you know, the way, because again, you guys were showing lots of visuals. You're showing lots and lots and lots and lots of examples. And, you know, one, it sounds like it was very much of a collaborative process at home, where it wasn't just you imposing this, imposing this almost maybe even consequence onto the child. It was more of a, hey, we got to eat something, right? We got to eat
together, right?
Yes, right. And so you came up with
talk about the visual piece and the lessons behind visuals. That's an important one that we didn't talk about. Many of the visuals that we make with our kids and for our kids are made collaboratively with them. Like, this is a part of your day that might be tricky. We talk about whenever there's chaos and something's not going well, that's a really good sign that you probably need to add a visual there. So working with the kids that's having that struggle, you know, what are some things that you could do instead? And let's find a picture to go with that. So they do work with us to make a lot of the visuals.
And it's funny that the food chart came up, because it must have been like this time of year that I made that with my son several years ago, because it came up on my time hop. The night that he used it, I have a picture of him holding it up with a huge smile on his face. Like, I did it. Like, we got through supper. Nobody yelled. Nobody cried. It was much more peaceful family experience. And I got food in my body.
Yeah.
And I had to be disappointed because I didn't get dessert because I didn't eat any supper. So,
yeah. And I think, and two, bring it even more full circle, maybe this is like an outer circle. This is almost the same, you know, this collaborative process that you're talking about doing with your kids at school, that you talked about doing, that you did with your son, is the same process. Like, that is teaching them, like, okay, this is, we have a challenge, we have a problem here. How are we going to solve it? Okay, so we're going to add a visual. How the visual could help us work through this problem is the same. You had a problem with the way the things were when you came home. And so the way that you solved the problem was use visuals in a way that it wasn't coming in and yelling day after day, why isn't this way? You guys should know better. How many times do I have to tell you? And so I think kind of going through this process and doing this collaboratively with children and then coming up, you know, with a visual and having them be a part of that process will help them in the future, you know, when they have a family or even in the workplace too, because visuals are also already very present in our workplace. But, you know, they could help continue to solve problems in their lives. So I really like that. And then you also made another really good point about, like, their, you know, a lot of times this happens so often on the internet, we'll see a glimpse of something. And, you know, I very much understand how it can happen because everyone is having their own experience in life and coming up, bumping up against that visual and interpreting it in a million different ways. And maybe they're adding the context of their life, right? And they're not necessarily thinking that, like, it's important for them. This may be a little bit more important for them to eat in your situation because it might be the only meal they have for the next 12 hours, right? Where in a lot of other situations, like, okay, you don't eat, there'll be another, when you're hungry, there'll be food available, right? There'll be a snack available or fruit or whatever.
Family around the table and
that's
the reality of our kids.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. So I think that that's some definitely powerful context.
You have to think again. I think we talked about it already. It's the intention behind the visual, and that's the important piece.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, like, I also too, I'm also not bashing. I also want people to be who are listening, or maybe you felt the same way, that also not bashing your criticism and being critical, because it is important that we think consciously and thoughtfully about what we're doing and, you know, the impacts. There's a lot of things that it may move us to one end, but it might, you know, it might take away from something else, or it might be harmful in another way. And so to have a community of people who are like, hey, like, tell me more about that. Or like, let's. Yeah.
And it's okay to disagree. Like, right. We can have two different beliefs about something and have a conversation about it and maybe learn a little bit from each other and move on.
Yeah. And too, I'm also going to encourage people who are, if you're listening to this right now and you're part of the conversation, you heard it, you know, or you, you know, have more thoughts on this topic, please message me on Instagram and share those thoughts, and we can kind of continue pick up the conversation. And you know, it might even be cool, you might even get to see their faces in person, and we can do an Instagram live or something like that. And so let's continue to talk about this, but we're going to move on to the next question that I had for you. That's something that's come up too a lot in videos, as because in conscious discipline, we're conscious discipline practitioners here. And two, I just want to do a little bit of a side if someone's asking, like, man, you've been talking about conscious discipline a lot lately. One of my goals of talking about conscious discipline and talking more about a specific framework is so that you know, maybe might spark your interest and you might dive deeper into conscious discipline and get a whole new set of tools, rather than just a tool from here, from this person. And while very much encourage people to still go out and look at other resources and find other resources, sometimes it might be, I think it can be helpful to have one kind of whole approach, so that you can, that, you know, the, that you try one skill, you already kind of know what skill to go to next, because it's all wrapped into the approach. It's all connected. Rather, when sometimes we get pieces of information, we may not know how it connects to something else that comes up. So that is part of the reason.
Changing conscious discipline is life changing, because it's all about the adult first. So it's about you regulating yourself and having those skills within you before you can co-regulate or help anybody else. So the adult first piece is huge, huge.
Yeah. And to just quickly, when you first heard about conscious discipline, were you just 100% on board? Were you a little bit?
I was all in. So it was about 14 years ago. There was a conscious discipline certified instructor in my state, and actually in the district that I was working in. And they had opened up their school. It was a brain-based charter school, and the entire school had been trained in conscious discipline. And it must have been like a half-day staff development. They had opened up their school to allow other teachers, you know, to walk through. And just immediately when you walk into a school that does believe and values conscious discipline, there's a different feel to it. Like, yeah. You can't really even put into words. It's a feeling. It just feels different. And as a young teacher, so many of the things that I already believed and was doing finally had a name. It was like I had so much belief already. And just being in a building that had the structures put in place and teachers who believed
the language
mm-hmm. and just a way to learn more, I was all in.
My conscious discipline journey didn't begin until Jenny and I were co-teaching, and we had a particularly hard day at school.
Early on our first year together.
And at the end of the school day, she handed me a book called Managing Emotional Mayhem and said, have you ever heard of this or read this? Like, no, but based on the cover, it looks like something I should read.
Yeah.
I took it home. I read it that night. I came back to school and said, yep, let's do it. I'm all in.
Yeah. Awesome. And you know, for many, many years, it was just Alyssa and I, you know, this is what we did in our classroom. And there were people that looked at us like, what are you doing?
All you do is happy kids up, and they get to do whatever they want, and they don't ever have to do any learning, which was the opposite of
true.
Right. Yeah.
we are able to do some really great things with some really,
really hard kids.
Yeah. Yeah. And two, they just mentioned the book Managing Emotional Mayhem, that it's all about learning to self-regulate, really yourself as an adult, and also how to teach children to self-regulate.
Which I was also a young mom at the time too. I had just had my first child when we first started teaching together. So talk about a great time for me to learn some new skills so that I didn't have to use the, you should be ashamed of yourself and go to your room and go sit in the corner. Which is the way I was parented. Right. And I knew there was a better way, and I wanted to do better by my own children.
And if you're looking, to get that book shipped to you for free, and it's still the year of 2022, you can use my promo code MrChaz2022 and get that book for free shipping from the Conscious Discipline website. Recommend it. So, and I actually want to veer off a little bit too, talk a little bit about parenting, because you mentioned early on in the conversation is that, like, by the time I get home, I'm all conscious disciplined out. I would love for you guys to talk a little bit about how you navigate that, right? Because it's, you know, those relationships with your family are deeper, and so those emotions can be deeper and harder to navigate. And you're already worn out from giving and giving. And when you're doing this, you know, whether you're doing conscious discipline or not, caregiving is emotionally draining. It is so much that you're giving. And a lot of times, you know, you're not doing, you know, conscious discipline, and you're not really conscious. You're just doing things the way that you were raised. Like, a lot of times it's like, there's anger and fear that you're, you know, expressing. That's emotionally draining as well. Just as much if you're giving with love and just pouring love out, they're both emotionally draining. But I want to know how you do that as a parent, how you do it all day, and then how do you go home
for our own families?
Yeah,
they deserve every ounce of it too.
Mm-hmm. Right. Talk a little bit about that.
I often said to my husband, like, our kids shouldn't get what's left over. They should be getting the best of us. So it is very much a conscious effort when I walk through the door of my house, knowing I'm going to be greeted by three of my most precious things in my life that need the best from me, not mom's done. She's got no patience left. It's going to be an ugly night. So it is very much a conscious effort on my part of how I'm going to respond to my kids. And that regulation starts with me, and I have to keep myself in check to be the best parent for them. And don't get me wrong, I make mistakes every single day, every single night, but it's giving myself grace and realizing, oops, I can do better in the next moment. I don't have to beat myself up about that, which I still do.
But those honest conversations with your kids too.
I very much do.
This is what I did, and it was a mistake.
Yesterday morning was a perfect example. You know, first winter snow in Wisconsin, and it's time to bust out the winter boots, and the boots are too big for my son, and he doesn't like how they fit on his feet, and the boots go flying across the room, and he's yelling and crying.
And you're going to be late for work, and you got to get
three kids ready and out the door by myself. And I yelled. And I shut the cupboard door really hard, and I thought, oh, shoot. And I stopped and I took a breath and I turned around and I said, Hendrix, I made a mistake. So I scooped him up and we breathed together, and he cried, and I felt like the world's worst mother, because now I just modeled for my child what I don't want him to do. Took a breath. We talked about it. Problem solved it. I said, your boots don't feel the way you want them to feel. I can't fix that right now. This is really hard. I said, you've got a choice. You can wear your shoes to school and not play in the field in the snow, or you can wear your boots to school and they'll feel funny, but you can play in the snow. Which one would be better for you? Well, I want to play in the field. Then it sounds like you have to wear the boots to school. Okay. And I talked about, I know they don't fit you right. We'll go to the store. We'll get you some new boots when we have some time. But for right now, this is the moment. We can't change this. But yeah, I have honest conversations with my kids all the time.
The conscious piece too about really, really consciously making sure that you are breathing and regulated yourself. I often drive home now. My son is 23 and did not grow up with a lot of my conscious discipline knowledge. But like I said, so much of this already was a part of me. But the when I drive home, either I'm going home to my four dogs or my husband, but no matter where I'm going in the world, often I drive home in complete silence and just take that time to really just really consciously breathe and regulate myself. And, you know, our days, even on good days, they're still long, they're still hard. Mm-hmm. We deal with a lot of emotion in our classroom, and that can take a lot out of you. So really taking that time for myself is hugely, hugely important.
And the conversations I have with my husband all the time are, we want our kids to grow up with different skills than we had as adults, that we, that were modeled for us. It doesn't feel good to be yelled at. It doesn't feel good to be sent to your room. It doesn't feel good to, I was a shyster of a child. It doesn't feel good. I don't want that for my kids.
Right.
And it takes a heck of a lot of effort on our part to be disciplined enough to regulate ourselves and make a conscious different choice for them. It's hard.
Adult first.
Yeah.
And that's us.
Yeah.
And it's not always perfect.
Yeah.
But again, the power of the oops, you know, we teach our kids.
Yeah.
It's okay to make mistakes. We all make mistakes. That's how we learn and grow. But to be honest about it, we make mistakes as teachers all the time. We make mistakes as moms, as wives, but being able to have those honest conversations.
And then you hear it fall out of their mouth like, oh, you're having a hard time. Let's breathe together. And you're like, I am doing something wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are definitely moments to celebrate. Yeah.
Far between sometimes.
Yeah.
Parents is no joke.
Yeah.
And to all of you single parents out there, like, wow. Like,
my favorite, my husband is a police officer, and he has also learned a lot of conscious discipline skills along the way. So my favorites are when he comes home from work and tells a story about how he conscious disciplined either, you know, some of the people that he came into contact with or people that he works with, or it's just, it shifted his language and his reactions too. So it really makes that ripple that just, that spreads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'm a big believer that everyone needs it in every profession and every industry. And I think, I think life would be so much better for a lot of us. If we all practice conscious discipline, or even if half of us practice conscious discipline, life would be a lot better. Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And so big things that I heard there is being very intentional about practicing self-regulation and kind of making that space on the drive home and just being intentional about it. Two, doing your best to be aware when you do make the oops, you do make the mistake, and catching yourself. Three, being intentional about how you apologize, you own up to it, you don't try to hide your mistake, you're open, which I think is just as powerful as not making the mistake at all. If anything, more powerful, to make the mistake and to show them how to come back from it. And then also talking about problem solving. I also heard a lot of just talking to each other, whoever you're doing this with, and just kind of like building, continuously talking to each other, building each other up, sharing perspective, reminding each other of our power of perception, so that we can stay composed. That's powerful. All right, I'm going to shift gear. Go ahead.
No. Our big piece too is that connection piece. And it's really hard when it's kind of like a punch in the gut when you realize your kid's having a hard time and they're really looking for that connection from you. And it's like, I'm their mom. I should be the most connected person to them. And really taking that time to not focus on all of the yuck that they're giving to you, but knowing that that yuck is them saying, I need you. I need you to spend time with me. I need you to love me. I need you to be with me, and not fix my behavior and not talk about my behavior. Let all of that go and just be really intentional about the time that we're spending together. That's every time I go to a conscious discipline conference, I walk away and think, oh, that's why he's having a hard time. He needs me to be more connected to him. So that really, that foundation and connection is another biggie.
Yeah. You know what? I think a lot of times when we talk about connection, or especially like people outside of conscious discipline, when they hear that, you're like, well, I have a good relationship with my child. Like, they know that I love them. And I, and, you know, why don't you kind of speak to that? Because I already see some like facial expressions going. So I think you can get kind of where I'm going. And I, you know, I heard a lot. Like, I love my child. My child knows that they love me, that like we do connection time. And so like, what do you mean? It can't be connection, because
when we talk about connection and conscious discipline, it's very different. It's very intentional. When we talk about making a connection, it has four components: eye contact, touch, presence, and a playful situation. So it's more than just, oh, I'm walking down the hall and I wave to you and I see you every day and oh, we have a connection. It's that intentionally taking time to do something silly, playful together in a meaningful way where we are building that relationship and that genuine connection, because we're taught in conscious discipline that the connections we make on the outside with other people build connections on the inside that actually rewire the brain for impulse control and willingness. And that as parents and teachers and people in this world, what we really want is that willingness and that impulse control, and connection is how we achieve that in fun, playful situations.
Yeah.
I've got one of my kids at home, and I'll talk about the home piece because I do have the littles at home, that every time he's asked to do a chore, he flops on the floor and he's pitching a fit because he doesn't want to do the chore. And I could focus on that, and you're going to do what I tell you to do. It's your job to empty the dishwasher tonight. Get up and take care of this. Let's go. Or I can take that as a, he needs me to connect with him first to be able to follow through with what I'm asking him to do. So I was really brilliant this summer, and I called Jenny. I said, Jenny, I tried an experiment at home and it worked. I said, so I tried this thing where I did an I love you ritual with Hendrix every time before I asked him to like do a job, just to see if that would be enough that would then get him to do the job without pitching a fit. And it worked. Duh, I know this. And it was as simple as 30 seconds touching our fingers together, looking at each other, smiling, being with each other, singing a little song, hugging each other. And then I would finish and say, all right, you've got a job to do and I know you can do it. It's your turn to empty the dishwasher. Go get started. And there you go, skipping away. Mm-hmm. Like it sounds as easy as that, but it took me as the mom to check myself, regulate myself first, to see him in a different way and to know
plan into place.
He wasn't doing it to be a stinker. He was doing it because he needed to know that I was there for him no matter what.
We talk about reframing when you want to say somebody's attention seeking, reframe it as connection seeking.
Yeah.
And that's just the whole intent.
And they aren't giving me a hard time. They're having a hard time. He was having a hard time following through, and he needed to know I was there for him and could help him through that before he could get started on that.
Love it. All right. So let's go into, I've been trying to ask this question for like 20 minutes, but this has just had such great conversation. This probably will become an Instagram live at some point, but something that is, you mentioned, and this is actually a pretty good segue. It would have been a good segue if I didn't set it up this way and now talking about the segue, but we were talking about connection, and one of the components is eye contact. And eye contact is really, we talk about that a lot in conscious discipline as a way to connect, and, you know, as a way to download calm, right? And so, you know, you both work with special ed, and so you both work with children who are on the spectrum where eye contact may feel uncomfortable, where eye contact may not come as easily as it does to a typical child. And by the way, I might start changing my language, typical, non-typical, but that's a different conversation. We're gonna have that conversation next, but put a pin in that. Y'all listen, we'll talk about it another time. But for now, because this is general, that's how we generally talk about it. Help us out. How do we, you know, what are your thoughts of conscious disciplines using a lot of eye contact? does it still work for children who are on the spectrum, where eye contact is uncomfortable? Are you still able to download Calm? Are you still able to connect with them? See a lot of head nods, yes. But now I'm going to let you guys explain and talk to people who are, who have a question.
So ideally, you do have all four components: eye contact, touch, presence, and a playful situation. But you don't need all four all of the time. A good example of that is during the pandemic. We weren't able to physically touch. We were still able to connect. Mm-hmm. And you just find other ways to connect and take out the touch piece. The eye contact piece.
We don't ever demand eye contact.
No, it's not about compliance. It's about willingness. Mm-hmm. And when they are comfortable, they will be willing.
Mm-hmm. So much of it is about the felt sense that's coming, the energy that we're putting out for our kids to feel helps to build that connection too. And I can remember when Jenny and I first came to this school and started this program that we're doing now, and we would start with a Brain Smart Start in the morning. And part of that is a connection activity, which, you know, ideally you have those four components, and it would be the two of us doing it together and the kids either not looking at us, looking at the floor because they were so uncomfortable, looking at us like we had seven heads on our shoulders. They were so uncomfortable because the group of kids that we have had never felt a positive connection from a person at school before. So here we are singing and dancing and tra-la-la-ing, and we're thinking, this is going to be great. They're going to do it with us. Looking at us like they weren't even looking at us. They were like so pretending that, yes, they were so uncomfortable.
And that's okay.
We kept doing it every single day. And eventually they all joined in because it felt safe enough for them to be vulnerable to participate in something like that. Now there, we still have a little girl right now that eye contact is very uncomfortable for her for a lot of different reasons. And when she will participate in what conscious discipline calls I love you rituals, but a lot of times she's looking away from you or looking at the floor, but she's still in that moment with you. And then she'll give you that brief little hint and you smile at her and you shoot that energy to her and away she looks. So it's short snippets, yeah. And eventually they feel safe enough and vulnerable enough in your presence to maybe grow that and maybe not, but it doesn't mean that you can't have a connection with someone if they don't look at you.
And the downloading calm piece, they don't need to look at us to feel our calm. Mm-hmm. If next to us, if we're touching their arm, if, you know, we're behind them and they're sitting in mm-hmm. front of us and they can feel us when we're taking a breath, mm-hmm. they can feel that breath. So there are lots of workarounds for that, but I think the important piece to remember is it's not about the compliance. Mm-hmm. They're not looking at you because they're being disrespectful, or mm-hmm. it's about taking them where they're at and understanding the intention behind what we're trying to get to, and forcing that eye contact is really going against.
You're ruining your connection.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Thank you. I don't even know how long you've been talking for. But I think it's a good time to kind of wrap it up and let you just tell us any last words or anything you want to say or any messages that you want to share with the world. This is your last chance. You each got a chance.
Not looked into anything conscious discipline related. Highly, highly recommend it. It is life changing. We are not getting paid to say this. We are true, true believers. Lots of free information available on the Conscious Discipline website. Start with a book.
Find your people.
Yeah.
Rely on other people. Like I wouldn't want to go this alone, nor would I be the teacher I am or the mom I am if I were in this alone.
Right.
Find your people who support you and believe in you and lift you up.
Yeah.
And
take care of you.
Yeah.
You know, this really teaches adults how to do the best for themselves first, because, you know, you can't give what you don't have.
Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Jenny and Alyssa, Jalissa. I see it. I don't think I've ever met anyone who's had a tattoo of something of their school a school mascot on their arm. So you got.
They're the kind of
koalas. We're showing you.
Yeah.
Koalas in our school family means more to us than just being teachers. It is truly a part of our life, and
it's about the journey.
It's about what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we are crazy. We do have koalas tattooed on us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Family.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that speaks volumes of just how much you have just been connected on this journey. And how you've kind of learned and grew together.
To have each other to do that with.
Yeah.
When you're delving into something new, it can be scary. But when you have somebody else with the same passion and the same philosophy and beliefs that you do, oh my gosh,
anything's possible.
There's so much power in that. So find your people, find your person.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?